Consider this a foreword. This episode was first recorded when my podcast was in its infancy. I barely knew how to record, let alone how to produce a podcast properly. And while I'm far from perfect at my craft, my skills have come a long way. The past year has witnessed Deep Into History go from complete obscurity to be chosen to be a finalist for the People's Choice Podcast Award, and I owe it all to you. Thus, it gives me great pleasure to give you this tale the way it was meant to be heard, re-edited, partially rewritten, remixed, and remastered. This was my favorite episode to write because in a strange way it reconnected me with my roots, even though at the time of this tale my family was on the opposite side of the Greek world. Please enjoy the epic journey of Pyrrhus of Epirus in its entirety for the first time in a single episode. It is one of the craziest true stories in history. Men raised on the Iliad fighting as Greek heroes against the all-consuming discipline of Roman legionaries. In addition, much of the dialogue in our points of view sections are pulled directly from the history books. In some cases, people who were actually there to hear the words spoken. Consider that as we go forward, and with that said, this forward comes to an end. Before we begin, I would like to thank my newest patrons, Kara, Courtney, and Brian, who attained the rank of historian by going to patreon.com/deepintohistory and pledging their support. Kara, Courtney, and Brian, my new historians, I salute you and thank you from the center of my being. As you know, I write my scripts while listening to epic music. Today's episode was written exclusively to the beat from Half and Half by Gangstar, one of the most sonically perfect experiences in existence. Guru, rest in peace. DJ Premier, we love you, man. Gangstar forever. I can only imagine that Pyrrhus would love this lyric and feel that Guru was singing it about him. This world's a twisted maze, but I got the swiftest blades. My swords, they can slice and dice precise ways. Those who come against me can get blaze, blade, and laid. No trace, just a glimpse of my face hit in the shade. You look up, there's a full moon in the sky, and all my would-be enemies, yeah, they're soon to die. Let's go. This is Deep Into History, and I'm your host Arjun Hundle. I want to introduce you to Pyrrhus of Epirus, the subject of today's episode, the same way I discovered him in a history book so many years ago. I'm going to ask you to take a moment to take a trip of the imagination and just dream with me. Ready? Then let's go. It is the year 193 BCE. You're in an almost offensively opulent palace in the city of Susa, in the old heart of the Persian Empire, now the second city of the Seleucid Empire, home to the royal court of Antiochus III, king and near god to millions of subjects. His kingdom is one of the four great successor realms that emerged from the rivers of blood spilled after the death of Alexander the Great. You are an envoy from a warlord from the far east, here to treat with the great king. All around you, Greek is the spoken language. As you don't understand this foreign tongue, you've been appointed a translator. You are sitting on luxurious cushions covered in silk so fine that each one is worth a small fortune in silver. You are at the far end of a very long table, at the head of which sits the king, and at either hand, two very esteemed guests. You have heard their names, as everyone in the world knows of the exploits of Hannibal of Carthage, the nemesis of the Romans, and the man that finally defeated him and brought mighty Carthage to its knees at the Battle of Zama 7 years ago, the highly esteemed Scipio Africanus, former consul of Rome. Two warriors out of myth and legend made flesh. Your interpreter informs you that Hannibal was exiled from Carthage after the Great War due to pressure from this very Roman, and now resides as an honored exile at this court. Scipio is here to settle a dispute with the king, yet both he and Hannibal are completely ignoring the monarch and icily staring at one another. Scipio's arrogance comes off him in waves, and the glare from Hannibal's one eye seems to contain all the wild anger of his defeated continent. The tension between the titanic personalities spreads, and soon the crowded room is filled with silence, all eyes on the pair, all ears trained to catch their words. It's as if the bejeweled and garishly clad monarch, the long table filled with every imaginable delicacy, the dozens of servants and the hundreds of onlookers fade away as if they don't exist. It's just the two generals. There is the barest hint of a nod between them. Scipio asks something, and Hannibal gives a long answer. Your translator whispers in your ear. Scipio asked who, in Hannibal's opinion, are the greatest generals of all time. Hannibal named Alexander, king of the Macedonians, first, because with a smaller force he routed armies many times larger, and no one has ever conquered more lands or more peoples and travels to the very ends of the earth. Africanus asked who was the second greatest general. Hannibal named Pyrrhus of Epirus because he was the first to teach the art of making an army camp properly, and no one ever chose ground more discriminatingly to place his forces. He also had the art of winning men over to his side so that the Italian people preferred to serve him, a foreign king, rather than the Roman people. Africanus asked who was third. Hannibal named himself, and the silence resumed. You have never heard the name before. You ask your translator who this Pyrrhus of Epirus is. His voice fills with respect and reverence, and he says, a brilliant general who defeated Rome in 2 major battles and vanquished every force Carthage put in his way. Tell me more, you say. A commander of such caliber that even in defeat his enemies came to respect him immensely. Go on. A hero who fought in the front lines of every battle and proved to be invincible in combat. Tell me everything, you growl, frustrated at your translator's one-liners. A cousin of Alexander who led an army into Italy and conquered all who opposed him, yet proved unable to capitalize on his victories. You grab the man and shake him violently. Tell me everything, you fool. An adventurer who never knew when to quit while he was ahead. A warrior who belonged in the Age of Heroes in the time of Achilles and Hector and the fall of Troy. A warrior who never lost a duel, though he fought hundreds of them. A warrior whose prowess was so great that men called him the Eagle, because like the great raptor, he could strike anywhere on the battlefield and expertly turn the tide in his favor. The translator goes silent and, your eyes dart back to the pair of generals as Scipio laughs and says, what would you say if you had defeated me? Then, beyond doubt, Hannibal replies, I should place myself both before Alexander and before Pyrrhus and before all other generals. You see Scipio Africanus smile and nod arrogantly. Yet you can't help but allow yourself the smallest smile at the backhanded compliment Hannibal had just delivered with such sly nuance. You see that though Hannibal has just acknowledged that he and Carthage lost to the man, in no way did he recognize him as one of the greatest of all time. Under your breath, you allow yourself a quiet chuckle. Allow the tension of that epic meeting to pass. Let the palace fade away. Come back to deep into history and hear me say, this is the tale of the man living in the shadow of the greatest conqueror the world had ever known, who shared his blood and above all a desire to outdo him. The tale of the war that becomes the warm-up match that would decide who would rule the Mediterranean world once and for all. The tale that inspired the greatest sci-fi battle in history. The saga of a warrior forged in the crucible of the greatest civil war the ancient world had ever known, who fought so expertly and with such devastating effect that in battle for his allies it was as if Alexander fought with them, Achilles reborn. So take a deep breath, let it out slowly, put some smoke in the air if you choose, and let your mind flow to my voice as we go deep into the year 280 before the Common Era and experience the wars of Pyrrhus of Epirus. This is the tale of how he became forever after known as the enemy of Rome. Pyrrhus, the last hero. Welcome. The world Pyrrhus of Epirus was born into was dominated by a giant of history, a legend in his own time, who was worshipped as a god by tribes in the east. Because just before Pyrrhus was born, Alexander of Macedon walked the earth and had conquered the known world. His relatively small but professional army had utterly destroyed the vast multitudes of the Persian Empire. Macedonia controlled Greece, Egypt, Babylon, Anatolia, Persia, Bactria, and the fertile Punjab. Alexander had turned the relatively small kingdom into a massive empire with hundreds of millions of subjects in just 12 years, and in those same years had gone from king to emperor to a god worshipped by millions. To his battle-weary army and its commanders who had followed him across the world and into faraway India, enough was enough. They had beaten every foe, and through conquest were all now rich men. They had not seen their homeland or their families in over a decade, and they just wanted to go home. Faced with mutiny in India, Alexander was grudgingly forced to turn around and march back to Babylon. Rumors of a new power rising in the west had reached his ears, and most experts agree that he had set his sights on conquering mighty Carthage and punishing a young upstart nation that was troubling the Greek colonies in what was called Magna Graecia, which meant Greater Greece, the upstart being the Republic of Rome. Alas, we'll never know what Alexander would have done, because after a few days of feasting and drunken parties in Babylon, he fell into a coma. Days later, surrounded by his generals in his royal chambers, Alexander opened his eyes. They begged him to name a successor or give instructions as to who would lead his empire after him. Legend says that Alexander whispered, "To the strongest." He closed his eyes and died, with many of his subjects believing that he had ascended to Olympus to take his rightful place among the gods. This set off a series of wars called the Wars of the Diadochi, or more poetically, the Funeral Games, to see which of his generals would win control of the vast empire he had created. The death of this giant of history sent the ancient world into the chaos of a seemingly unending war of intrigue, assassinations, death, and revenge. 2 years after this, with the massive wars well underway, our prince is born in Epirus, modern Albania. His aunt was Olympias, Alexander's mother, in my opinion, the true lion of Macedon. While Alexander was away conquering the world, she ruled Greece and Macedon. Olympias ruled expertly and was both loved and feared. Most people think of Alexander as Philip II's son. Know that he was no less Olympias's, a formidable woman who raised a formidable son on tales of her family's descent from Neoptolemus, son of the legendary Greek warrior Achilles. Baby Pyrrhus looked to be in for a charmed life, except after Alexander's death, the war spreads, and Epirus, like so many peripheral kingdoms, is inevitably pulled in. Pyrrhus's father, the king of Epirus, agrees to aid his cousin Olympias and becomes the enemy of many other factions. The wars of the Diadochi are extremely complicated, and indeed convoluted. It would take many hours to explain its twists and turns, so I'll stick to how it affects baby Pyrrhus, another classic deep into history contextual nutshell for you. In punishment for invading Macedonia with Olympias, Epirus is invaded, and his family is sent into exile. The 2-year-old baby Pyrrhus is smuggled out of the country by loyal servants and taken to the north to the king of the Illyrians, who rejects massive fortunes for his death. In this time, anyone who shared blood with Alexander was in extreme danger. The king took a liking to the prince and decided to raise him among his own children. Pyrrhus is trained in ancient wisdom, Greek philosophy, the Iliad, and the arts of war. He excelled at combat with sword, shield, and spear and learned battlefield tactics. He is so impressive that he proves himself in battle at age 12. Shortly after this, his benefactor sends an army with him and installs him on his rightful seat, the throne of Epirus. The tides of the Great War ravaging the Greek world turn, causing him to lose control of his kingdom. He ends up in the service of the King of Macedon and fights in the penultimate battle of the funeral games when he is 17, the Battle of Ipsus. This battle has received a deep into history treatment in a Patreon episode called The Closing Ceremonies. Let's just say it was one of the largest and most decisive battles in ancient history. All the major players were there. It was one of those rare battles that settle many old scores. The forces arrayed by each side are of epic proportions and, more to the point, exceptional quality. Nearly every soldier there had fought and survived many major battles, except Pyrrhus, who's leading a small contingent of Epirate cavalry among a much larger wing. During the titanic battle, Pyrrhus led charge after charge fearlessly. He was an exceptionally gifted warrior and led his formation to devastating effect, even against war elephants. Though his side lost the battle, even his enemies on the battlefield said that he fought like Alexander reborn. In the aftermath, he was taken as a hostage for the losing side's good behavior to Egypt. There he was treated with honor and respect by Ptolemy, Alexander's bastard brother, general, and now the powerful king of his own realm. Pyrrhus wowed Ptolemy's court with displays of arms and duels and won the affections of his captors, so much so that he was given the hand of Ptolemy's stepdaughter in marriage, as well as a massive dowry which he used to reclaim his throne in Epirus. His homeland consisted of a small part of northwest Greece and much of modern Albania. It was a land dominated by one very large tribe, the Milesians, with many smaller subsidiary tribes. These tribes, though somewhat ethnically different, were bound together culturally. They spoke accented Greek, worshipped the Greek gods, and embraced Greek philosophy. The tribes were considered barely above barbarians by many mainland Greeks because they lived in small towns and hundreds of villages instead of cities. Still, Epirus had some very famous temples that drew devout pilgrims from all over the Greek world. First among these was the Necromantion of Acheron, a temple devoted to Persephone and Hades, god of the underworld. It was said to be built on the doorway to the afterlife, and that its priests could channel the thoughts and desires of the dead so that the living could converse with them. Pyrrhus became a devotee and patron of the temple, and always consulted the necromancers who allowed him to speak with the likes of Alexander and Achilles before making major decisions. To the ancient Greeks, their gods were real, part of everyday life. Books like Homer's Iliad and Odyssey were seen as history and consulted for wisdom the way religious people do today with any of the holy books. Having access to the necromancers, and through them the advice of long-dead heroes, would have been seen as a huge advantage for Pyrrhus, and the king of Epirus jealously guarded access to them. Over the next few years, his fame increased immensely as he won battle after battle. In one such battle in Greece, he was challenged to single combat by a famous warrior. He agreed only if the duel was binding and would settle the war then and there, with no need for the men of both sides to shed further blood. The terms agreed. They fought on a field between the two gathered armies. Pyrrhus's skill at arms was second to none. He slew the champion with ease and was afterwards cheered by both sides. Many of the enemy troops decided to join him after witnessing his skill, wishing to serve this new Alexander. He won so many victories that he even became king of Macedon for a short time, before being forced to abdicate by greater powers. As we approach the year 280 before the Common Era, the Greek world is stabilized, with large and strong successor kingdoms carved out of Alexander's empire, Epirus being a small kingdom on the western fringes of that world. This is when all the royal courts start receiving embassies from Tarentum, a Greek city-state in Magna Graecia. That's the south of Italy, the shoe if you will, and the ball it's kicking, Sicily. It translates to Greater Greece and was considered the frontier of their world, full of small and large Greek colony cities. Though independent from their original homeland, they were ethnically and culturally the same people. Sicily is where the Greek world traded and constantly warred with the Empire of Carthage. The ambassadors came with a plea for help against a new power rising in Italy, the Republic of Rome. Rome had just come through decades of war and conquered all of central Italy, making allies of or subjugating all the cities it came across, exterminating those who would not assimilate to their new order. Triumphant in central Italy, and honestly provoked by the unwise and arrogant Greek cities, Rome had now set its sights on Magna Graecia. To the massive Greek powers in the east, the Romans would have seemed like barbarian upstarts who needed to be taught their place. The Greek kings didn't treat the threat lightly, however. They decided to send their most famous warrior at the head of a large army. From Egypt came gold, soldiers from Macedon, ranged troops from the Greek islands, and from the Seleucids, 20 Indian war elephants, the super weapon of the ancient world. In addition, the powers guaranteed the safety and protection of Epirus for as long as he was away, if only Pyrrhus would agree to handle the Romans for them. Pyrrhus, now 30, was eager for the extremely rare opportunity of leading a large army almost fully funded by other kings. But first he consulted the Oracle of Zeus at Dodona in southern Epirus, the second most famous in the Greek world besides the Oracle of Delphi. The Greeks believed that the oracles could speak to the gods and get glimpses of the future. We now understand that most of these temples were built on the intersection of fault lines so that the caves in their inner sanctums became filled with hallucinogenic gases through cracks in the ground. The oracle, usually a priestess of the god, in this case Zeus, would inhale deeply and go into a trance. You would then ask your question. Pyrrhus had lavished talents of gold to turn the previously rustic shrine into the religious center of his country. He had built walls, a beautiful temple for the oracle, and many other shrines, making it an attraction for the entire Greek world. As his chief benefactor, the king of Epirus would have been ushered past the waiting pilgrims and straight to the bowels of the temple, to the sacred cave, where the oracle would be undulating in a psychedelic trance, ready to be a conduit between the king and Zeus himself. Bracing himself for anything, because the advice of an oracle could sometimes bring devastating news, Pyrrhus asked what would happen if he carried out his plan. The oracle instantly stopped moving, and her eyes shot open, staring directly into Pyrrhus's, and she said, "You, if you cross into Italy, Romans shall conquer." She closed her eyes and resumed her trance. These kind of cryptic replies to questions asked of the gods were very common. It was rare in the extreme to get a simple yes or no. Pyrrhus took the oracle's prophecy to mean that he would succeed. He quickly rode back to his palace where he summoned his best friend, advisor, and ambassador at large, Cineas, to plan the campaign. Cineas was considered wise and learned by many rulers because he had studied with the greatest historians and philosophers of the day. It's from their conversations that we know Pyrrhus thought that he could quickly deal with the Romans and then plan to move to Sicily and there rally support from the Greek cities, then attack his true intended target. Pyrrhus wanted to complete Alexander's plan, invade Africa and conquer the mighty city of Carthage, and take over its vast empire. An extremely bold plan, and might seem impossible but for the fact that this was Pyrrhus, who men called the Eagle of Epirus, cousin of Alexander, and descendant of peerless Achilles. The Tarentine embassy at his palace stressed the urgency of the city's danger, and made crazy promises to Pyrrhus about the various cities of Magna Graecia, raising hundreds of thousands of soldiers and 20,000 cavalry to join him once he landed. It's safe to say that Pyrrhus didn't believe these ridiculous claims. Tarentum, though originally Sparta's only colony abroad, had long ago forgotten its warrior traditions, and was now a city of merchants and traders who hired mercenaries to fight their wars. It was decided that Pyrrhus would wait and assemble the various parts of his army, while Cineas would go ahead with a force of 3,000 Epirot infantry to secure and assure Tarentum, and, most importantly, get the lay of the land. Over the coming months, Pyrrhus assembled his impressive host. The core of the army was 16,000 Epirot and Macedonian phalangites, who were experienced and battle-hardened warriors that fought in the famous Macedonian phalanx, an ancient formation that had evolved from the relatively simple idea of lining up shield to shield, tightly packed, and pushing forward against the enemy while stabbing out with relatively short 8-foot spears, to its current and perhaps most potent iteration. The Macedonian phalanx, perfected by Philip II, Alexander's father, was the formation that allowed Macedon to conquer much of the known world. It involved bronze-armored troops in the first few lines, with the ranks behind less expensively armored in layers of heavy linen, with each man wielding an 18-foot pike called a sarissa. It was made of very solid and light wood, most likely cornel, and was topped with an incredibly narrow and razor-sharp spear point. When thrust at full force, sarissas could penetrate shield, armor, and the chest of the opposing warrior, and crucially, because of the design of the thin spearhead, could be easily withdrawn to be thrust again. Each warrior carried a circular bronze shield hung around the neck and shoulders, and could be managed with the left elbow. This allowed both hands to be kept on the sarissa and greatly increased its punch. What was so different about the Macedonian phalanx was that the warriors were given personal space. They were not densely packed together like the Spartan phalanxes of old. The 3-foot gap between men allowed the 5 ranks behind to lower their sarissas in the gap, making the formation extremely deadly and strong head-on. Imagine trying to pet an angry porcupine without getting stuck by a quill, and you'll have some idea why this formation was a nightmare for armies from Greece to India. In battle, the idea was that the phalanx would act as an anvil, holding an enemy army in place, while the cavalry quickly dealt with the enemy's horsemen and then took the opposing army in the side and rear. Made famous by Alexander's companions, Macedonian cavalry was some of the best in the world. Extremely maneuverable, they famously rode in a diamond formation with an officer on each point so that they could take command and turn the formation very quickly. They carried long, heavy spears and would charge in and out of combat again and again, expertly delivering shock after shock. Pyrrhus had 2,000 of these, with 1,000 lighter support cavalry, astonishingly fast and skilled horsemen. These Thessalians were expert at pursuing a routed enemy and screening the phalanx's flanks. The problem with the phalanx was that it took a very long time to deploy, and it could only move in one direction, forward. It was extremely vulnerable to attack from the flanks and rear, and could be decimated if attacked anywhere but from the front. To prevent this, the Greeks and then the Macedonians had developed highly specialized support units designed to protect the phalanx's integrity. In Pyrrhus's army, these included 2,000 archers perfect for disrupting enemy formations, 500 Rhodian slingers, which fired small lead balls, the bullets of the ancient world, each shot potentially lethal, and lest we forget, 20 Indian war elephants, the imperial walkers of the ancient world, along with a driver called a mahout. They carried a platform on their back called a castle, which contained 1 spearman and 3 archers. The war elephant was given wine before battle because war is not in an animal's nature, and when it was nicely buzzed, it became a deadly instrument of war. Part battering ram, steamroller, and mobile assault tower, it was absolutely devastating when used correctly. It did have one huge downside. When injured badly, the elephants became enraged and would trample friend and foe alike. When this occurred, the mahout had to kill the elephant with a large spike driven in with a hammer he carried for the task. This was only done in extreme cases because the elephants were so valuable. Oh, and rounding out the army, last but far from least, he brought 2 priests from the Necromantion of Acheron, one to channel Alexander, and the other the ancient Greek hero from the Trojan War, Achilles, his 2 most illustrious ancestors. It was their advice that would play a crucial role in the wars to come. The presence of the necromancers would strike fear and doubt into the minds of his foes and inspire his army. They were considered a rare and powerful resource. This was the army that he planned on conquering the West with, a powerful, professional, and lethal force. As Pyrrhus boarded his mighty flagship with the winds of the Adriatic sweeping through his hair to the beach beyond, filled with hundreds of Tarentine transports being packed full of his men, horses, and elephants, he must have felt that nothing could stop his plans, his conquests, and his eternal glory. He led the most lethal version of this type of army the Greek world had ever produced, tempered by centuries of innovation and hardened by decades of civil war. The confident man, powerful king, peerless warrior, now had what he always dreamed of, an army as capable in battle as he was in single combat. There was just a small matter of the barbarians, for that was how he saw the Romans, in Italy troubling the Greeks, and he would be free to reach for his destiny, to take on the power of Carthage, and turned the West into his empire, and finally equaled the deeds of his cousin Alexander the Great. Little did he know that the Macedonian way of making war was about to face its ultimate test, a new style of making war, a style that allowed a small city to conquer all the peoples around it, a style that had adapted to destroy the Greek phalanxes of Magna Graecia, a style that had never faced the Macedonian phalanx that had conquered the Greek world, and a style that was about to be pushed past its breaking point, the Roman style. Only a day out to sea, Pyrrhus's fleet was struck by a storm which grew more intense as they crossed the Adriatic and neared Italy. Many ships were blown far off course, and the fleet was scattered. With only a few dozen ships around his flagship, Pyrrhus, still in the grip of the huge storm, saw the Italian coast in the distance as lightning lit up the dark sky. Some of the flat-bottomed Tarentine transports were blocking his ship's path to the beach, haplessly struck and being buffeted by the sea swells. Refusing to give up with land in sight, Pyrrhus instructed his captain to follow him and proceeded to jump into the stormy sea and began to swim to shore. If this sounds like an insane decision to you, it's because it is. As our story progresses, you're going to notice a lot of, shall we say, strange or even bizarre decisions at crucial moments from Pyrrhus. It only really makes sense when you keep in mind that he is constantly being advised by two psychedelic mushroom-chomping necromancers who he believes are speaking with the voices of Achilles and Alexander the Great, which means that when they speak, Pyrrhus listens. Trust me, you're with your friend and lore master Arjun. This is a great story. Pyrrhus is a great warrior, and together we'll discover why men called him the Eagle of Epirus, and why he called his men his wind. Our tale only gets crazier after this. I hope you are enjoying the episode so far. I know I enjoy creating them for you. So please go to patreon.com/deepintohistory to pledge your support. You'll attain the rank of historian, and you'll get exclusive Patreon-only episodes, like when we go deep into the year 301 BCE and ride to war with a young Pyrrhus of Epirus in the Battle of Ipsus, and discover how the young Epirate prince distinguished himself among hundreds of thousands of troops, tens of thousands of cavalry, and 500 war elephants, so greatly that men who knew him said it was like fighting alongside Alexander again. Others said that they had witnessed peerless Achilles reborn. Join me and witness the titanic battle that rocked the ancient world and proved to be one of the final great events in the funeral games in an episode I call The Closing Ceremonies, available now, only on Patreon. It's just 10 cents a day and it means the world to me and the show. That's patreon.com/deepintohistory. Now, back to Pyrrhus, the Last Hero. Pyrrhus swam through the furious storm and made it to shore, and his ships followed him in. The next morning, when he takes stock of his forces, Pyrrhus only has 3,000 troops, a few dozen cavalry, and 2 war elephants. The local Greeks welcome him and give him guides to reach Tarentum. An easy way to picture Tarentum on a map in your mind is the inside of the heel of the boot that is southern Italy. Because of the storm, Pyrrhus had failed to round the heel and landed on the outside. A day later, when he and his men reached Tarentum, he was greeted by Cineas, his trusted friend, who had brought the vanguard to the city months ago. He informed Pyrrhus that the rest of his fleet had made it through the storm and that his army was intact. This was the only good news he got, however. It seems that he'd been misled by the Tarentine embassy. Cineas informed him that it was Tarentum that had provoked the attack when they turned a minor treaty violation by Rome into an act of war by attacking some Roman ships that entered their waters while they were on their way to aid another Greek city. The Romans had asked for compensation for their losses but were rebuffed rudely and continually provoked until they decided to declare war on Tarentum. In addition, he found the population to be fat and lazy merchants who had no intention of marching to war. These were the descendants of Spartan warriors, but had long ago forgotten their people's warrior code and become traitors, which bought them lives of excess, indulgence, and splendor. In their minds, Pyrrhus was just another mercenary captain hired to rid them of the Roman nuisance. And to add even more insult to injury, those promised hundreds of thousands of troops didn't exist. If all of Magna Graecia rose to help Pyrrhus, he could only expect a few thousand infantry and another few thousand cavalry. Naturally annoyed by their lies and their attitudes, Pyrrhus waited until his army occupied the city, and then proceeded to tell the Tarentines that he was banning all parties, drinking, festivals, and any activities except training for war with Rome. Many of the city's residents, left in protest to the ridiculous demands of this upstart tyrant, carried out on palanquins by their slaves because they were too fat to ride. Pyrrhus put the rest of the population through the same strict training regimen that his army did daily, In the end, he formed them into a decent support force for the flank of his phalanx, called the White Shields, that fought in an older-style Greek phalanx with shorter spears, and a small but very competent contingent of light cavalry scouts. Before long, word reached Pyrrhus that a large Roman army was in Magna Graecia, pillaging its way across the countryside on the way towards Tarentum. His phalanx would be wasted guarding the city walls and waiting for a siege, so he moved his army out to meet these Romans. The two sides close in on one another and meet near the village of Heraclea. Their armies made camp miles apart, separated by a wide plain with a river running through it. Pyrrhus spied on the Roman camp, which was neatly ordered and formidable with palisades and towers. He remarked to Cineas, "I know not what kind of barbarians these may be, but the disposition of the army that I see has nothing of barbarism in it." He dispatched Cineas as his envoy to treat with the Romans, offering to act as an arbiter between Rome and Tarentum to settle the dispute without bloodshed, also to delay for time, as he even promised troops from other Greek cities which were marching even now. The Roman consul in charge of the army, a man named Livianus, replied that he did not recognize Pyrrhus's authority, and that he had no fear of Pyrrhus's reputation. The Roman officers in the tent roared their approval and laughed. Shaking his head at their arrogance, Cineas turned to leave, and under his breath, with more than a little contempt, the diplomat said, "You will." What Cineas and Pyrrhus didn't understand was that the Romans of this era had every right to be arrogant. Rome had just vanquished and subjugated their perennial enemies, the Samnites in central Italy, after decades of warfare. In the previous centuries, Rome had been sacked by barbarian Gauls, lost many battles, but had always rebounded by learning from their mistakes and adopting the best tactics of their enemies. Their warrior ethos so well described by the final act of their founding myth, where the brothers Romulus and Remus, heroes to the Romans in the way that Hercules and Achilles were to the Greeks, while constructing their defenses of their separate settlements, they mocked one another, and when Remus jumped over the very first walls of Rome to show how weak they were, was met with a sword in his gut from his brother Romulus killing him, the lesson being that anything and everything was acceptable in the defense of Rome, even killing your own brother. Originally fighting in a Greek-style phalanx, it was during their wars with the Samnites that they had copied their enemy's more flexible form of fighting, which could handle many different types of terrain. These were the famous manipular legions, which arrayed on the battlefield in the quincax, the checkerboard formation. A maniple consisted of a block of 120 legionaries in three rows of 40 men each, with a maniple-sized gap between each unit. This gave the formation incredible flexibility, especially compared to the Greek phalanx. Individual maniples could operate independently from the rest of their line, allowing them to reinforce weak points or exploit breakthroughs. On making contact with the enemy, they would close the gaps and fight as a solid line, though still moving and fighting as an individual maniple. This way, only one line was engaged at a time, with the second and third lines ready for any surprises on the battlefield. The three battle lines were called the Triplex Achies. The first line, 1,200 young and less experienced Hastadii. They were lightly armored, carrying a gladius, a short stabbing sword, and a scutum, the rounded rectangular Roman shield, which would cover them from shoulders to shin. The second line consisted of 1,200 experienced and heavily armored princeps, men in their prime. Legionaries in the first two lines carried two pila, javelins designed to penetrate the enemy's shields. Then due to being weighted on the rear end, it would bend, rendering the shields useless. 600 veteran triarii made up the third line, who fought in a more maneuverable Roman-style phalanx. Armed as Greek hoplites, with a heavy spear, a round hoplon shield, and a gladius as a weapon of last resort, these men were esteemed as Rome's greatest warriors. The rest of the legion was comprised of 1,200 velites, very lightly armored skirmishers. They wore wolf's heads atop their own and screened the formation, peppering enemies with their seven light javelins, then retreating through the gaps to let the Hastati engage. Finally, 300 Roman cavalry, drawn from Rome's noblemen, the equestrian class. Mostly lightly armored, they fought with spear, shield, and the spatha, a long cavalry sword, excellent for dealing with a fleeing enemy.
In battle, the legion would conduct itself thusly. The velites would engage the enemy, throwing their javelins, and retreat through the gaps in the formation. Then the Hastadii, first throwing their two pila, and then engaging with scutum and gladius. When tired, the Hastadii would retreat behind the fresh princeps, who would launch their two pila and charge to engage. On the rare occasion where the princeps couldn't win the battle, both lines would retreat behind the triarii, who would either act as a holding force to allow an orderly retreat, or as happened more often than not, the elite veterans would turn the tide and win the battle. The Romans had a saying, "It has come to the triarii," meaning that the battle was particularly grueling and only Rome's best warriors had a chance of saving the day. Each legion was accompanied by a legion of companion ala, consisting of men from Roman allied cities, called Socii, usually consisting of cavalry, ranged and support troops. The name ala is where we get our modern word ally from. Thus a Roman legion with its companion ala numbered approximately 8,000 men. This is the type of legion that would defeat Carthage and be led by the likes of Scipio Africanus, perhaps the greatest general Rome ever produced. It was an innovative and devastatingly powerful way of making war, and it was about to be put to its ultimate test. With their camps miles away from each other, no sign of his promised Greek allies, and his overtures for a peaceful solution rejected with extreme contempt, Pyrrhus knew battle was imminent. The river Cirrus separated the landscape in half and was only fordable in a small stretch. So Pyrrhus dispatched his skirmishers, his archers and Rhodian slingers, to scout and keep an eye on Roman movements. They were also to stop any Roman efforts to scout the Epirot camp. When they neared the river, however, they saw that the Romans were forming their lines on the opposite bank. The Romans were coming to attack with their full army. This was an emergency, and word was quickly dispatched to Pyrrhus. The Macedonian phalanx was excellent, but it took a long time to form in good order. He needed to buy his army the time it desperately needed. If the Romans trapped them in their camp, or worse, got to attack them while the phalanx was still forming, they would be massacred. To make matters worse, his skirmishers were now under attack from the Romans and were being sorely pressed. The Roman army, under the command of the consul Livianus, was 4 legions strong, with another 4 Socii ala, and a few other contingents, a force totaling 40,000 men. Pyrrhus ordered all of his cavalry to assemble for battle. The 4,000 horsemen were split into 2 large groups to attack the forces trying to surround his skirmishers. His companion cavalry was as good as Alexander's, although far fewer in number, they were just as devastating in force and impact on the battlefield. The reason is they follow Pyrrhus, the greatest warrior since Alexander. In the years after the Battle of Ipsus, where his reputation was born, he had won dozens of single combats, and more battles fighting alongside these same men. He rode to the front of his personal formation, and the assembled cavalry roared, "Eagle! Eagle! Eagle!" gleaming in his splendid armor. His purple and gold thread cloak billowing out behind him, he replied, "If I am your eagle, know you are the wind that allows me to fly." The army roared their approval at the refrain that had become their battle cry. He put on his spectacular helm, decorated with the horns of the first ram he had hunted as a boy, eagle feathers formed to look like wings coming out of the sides, and finally a long plume of horsehair dyed green on the crest running down his back. He stood out from his men, who wore more or less uniformly plain and utilitarian gear. The truth is he wanted it this way. It was how a Greek hero went to war, easy to find on the battlefield, for friend or foe alike. Pyrrhus nodded to his signalers, who blew their trumpets to sound the charge. His Epirot and Macedonian cavalry formed into smaller 80-man diamond shapes with an officer at each point, the lighter Thessalians and Tarentine units forming a screen for the heavier companions. Their goal, to scatter any ranged units or light cavalry and then get out of the way of the heavy chargers. The dozens of diamond shapes were aimed at the flanks of the army slingers and archers under heavy attack from the Roman cavalry. At full gallop they charged in hard. The crash of thousands of men and horses colliding with one another would have been deafening. The first shock of the charge taking them in the flank would have routed most enemies, but the Romans quickly regrouped, reformed into a line, and closed to engage with spears at point-blank range, thus staying in close combat and robbing the companion cavalry of its chief ability of continuous charges and withdrawals, delivering shock after shock. Pyrrhus and his companions were in the fight of their lives. These Romans weren't breaking under his assault. You see, the Romans believed in the divinity of the Republic, and they fought with fanatical skill for their god. It was a foe unlike any they had faced before, a totally different, perhaps more lethal warrior code. The Romans too had not faced men like this. Raised on the Iliad, whose goal in life was to fight as well as the Greek heroes in Homer's epic. It is a battle of Greek heroes against Roman knights. Achilles had the Myrmidons, Alexander had his companions, and the Eagle of Epirus had his wind. Not to mention the 2 hooded and robed necromancers chanting prayers next to his signalers in the center of his formation. Now nobody knows what it would have been like in the middle of battle, reality distorted, perhaps enhanced, definitely altered by magic mushrooms, watching the Eagle of Epirus and his wind locked in the battle with the most difficult foe they had ever faced. But it might have gone something like this. Ready? Then let's go. You and your sworn brother, devotees and high priests of the Necromantian of Acheron, are in the middle of a fight out of legend. You are mounted in the relatively protected center of Pyrrhus' companions, his command unit, his best warriors, his wind. There is savage fighting all around you. The charge you had just been a part of had taken the Roman cavalry attacking the army's slingers and archers completely off guard. The impact and savagery of the attack should have set the Romans to flight. While they did withdraw, it was only a few dozen yards to regroup and attack in a line, even though their armor was much lighter than the Epirates. This resolve could only mean that they were now screening for the Roman legions that were crossing the river, which was not far away. From the far distance behind you, you hear the high-pitched flute that signals the phalanx is forming. Looking through the press of cavalry beyond, you see three men with the heads of wolves running towards you, about to throw javelins at the companions. Yet in the moment before they can launch, they fall, struck by lead balls from the slingers Pyrrhus had just saved. The fighting around you grows ever more intense, the screams of injured men and horses, the clang of metal meeting metal, and the wet sound of metal biting through flesh grow louder and louder. The eagle and his wind are the best warriors you have ever fought with, yet the Romans fight with great skill and fanatical bravery. You and your brother are sitting on chargers in the middle of the group with the king's signalers. Next to you on his mount is Cineas, the envoy, holding a half-nock bow, two quivers full of arrows on his saddle. His eyes dart around the battlefield. You briefly wonder why he isn't firing, for there is no shortage of enemy targets. Then your eyes are drawn to a Roman perhaps 50 yards from you. He is staring at Pyrrhus with hatred in his eyes. In a flash, he is at a full gallop, aiming a spear at Pyrrhus's mount. You notice that the Roman wears white socks. You wonder why you notice that. You blink. The charging Roman takes Pyrrhus's horse full in the chest, killing the animal. What you witness next should be impossible. Pyrrhus vaults off his stallion before it falls and throws his cavalry spear into the Roman's chest. When he lands, the straps on his shield rip, robbing the king of his protection. He tries to retrieve his spear from the body of the dead Roman, but cannot dislodge it quickly enough. He draws his storied sword, the blade of his ancestors, with his right arm. In his left, he picks up and reverses the Roman's long cavalry spatha. He knows that seeing him dismounted and vulnerable, every Roman in sight would try to claim the glory of killing the enemy king. In his very conspicuous gilded armor, his purple and gold cloak on his back, and the green crest plume of his helmet hanging down below his shoulder blades, with his very unique ram's horns and eagle feathers jutting out from the sides. Your dilated eyes take in everything. Romans from all over the front are rushing to kill Pyrrhus, except they can't. Every Roman who fights Pyrrhus dies. For the briefest second, helm and warrior become one, and Pyrrhus becomes a horned demon, his blades flashing out impossibly fast. The green plume on his helm becomes a blurred whirl, and it's as if he's a demon hunting the Romans covered in a ball of green fire, with enemies withering in front of him. You shake your head to clear your vision. To your right, Cineas is firing aim shots at amazing speed, covering Pyrrhus's flanks. Megacles, the king's trusted friend and bodyguard, with two warriors ride to his aid, leading a remount for the king. To your left, you hear your sworn brother say, "Achilles lives in him." You nod in agreement and say, "He is of the blood." And then, "It is time, brother." You both dismount, twins and opposites. You in black, fully devoted to Hades. Your brother in white, devoted to the goddess Persephone, your god's wife. You throw back your hoods, revealing Milesian tribal tattoos covering your faces. Swallow the mushroom stalks you had been chewing, and begin a ritual dance. Because you just don't channel the dead for Pyrrhus. You are battle priest, loyal only to the royal family of Epirus, the patrons of your temple. In battle, you have a job to do. Call down the wrath of your god. Your brother starts praying solemnly and with the utmost respect while gracefully dancing side to side in a ritual trance. "My goddess, most noble lady, your children need you. Innervate the men of Hellas with your powers of spring. Renew and soothe their wounds. Bless the soil that their sandals always find purchase on firm ground, and see that the grasses betray the Romans, causing them to slip, as you cause the land beneath their feet to experience the decay of fall." Your dance is awkward, spasmodic, jerky, and completely unnerving to everyone around you. You bellow, "Hear me, mighty Hades, lord of the underworld. These heroes fight to honor you with the souls of these barbarians. Reach up from the depths of your dark hall and take their souls into your cold embrace. Pull them down, down, into endless purgatory. Guide the swords of your children so that every wound they inflict festers and becomes lethal, and receive all these souls as a sacrifice to your eternal glory. You throw back your head and laugh as you feel your god's presence flowing through you and spreading across the battlefield. At least it might have gone like that. We know from their later actions, the superstitious Romans were terrified of the necromancers and took great pains to avoid their curses. Remember that magic, especially the power of the gods, was very real to these men. The fighting at the Battle of Heraclea is extraordinarily fierce. A horn blast from the distance indicates that the phalanx and the white shields, that's the Tarentine units protecting the flanks, are about to engage the legions. Megacles says to Pyrrhus, "My king, we can't keep this up. Plus, I don't like the way these Romans are looking at you. If they keep pushing you like this..." Pyrrhus, "Not even you can keep up this pace. Let us withdraw and switch armor. Let me take the attacks." Pyrrhus reluctantly accepts. They make a fighting withdrawal to the flanks of the phalanx, the Roman cavalry following closely. After they switch armor, Pyrrhus observes the situation on the battlefield. The phalanx and the legion are locked in brutal combat. The historian Plutarch writes that over the course of the battle, the legions attack 7 times, which means 3 rotations of the first 2 lines over the course of a few hours, and finally the battle had come down to the triarii. The Romans fought doggedly, almost suicidally trying to chop their way through the forest of razor-sharp spear points. Many do make it close enough for their sword work, and the first 2 ranks of the phalanx take heavy casualties. However, with ranks 16 men deep, there are always eager warriors ready to avenge a fallen comrade and take his spot at the front. This kind of head-on combat was what the Macedonian phalanx was designed to excel at. The problem was that in all previous battles, eventually the enemy would break and run, or the phalanx would pin the enemy in place for the cavalry to attack in the rear. This was not the case with the legions. They kept coming, and it seemed that the fresh rear rank had their greatest warriors. The noise, the clamor, the screams of dying men, the choking dust, and the stink of death would have been overwhelming. The battle had been going on for a few hours. Pyrrhus, with a small bodyguard, had been darting in and out of combat across the entire front. Whenever he saw a particularly devastating Roman warrior giving his men trouble, he would enter the fray to kill him and then move on to the next, always attacking where his men needed his help most urgently. Word reached him that Megacles, who had been leading the companions, had been killed, and that the Romans had propped up his armor on poles to show everyone that Pyrrhus was dead. He clenched his teeth. Rage at the death of his trusted friend and bodyguard filled him. He turns to his following signalers and yells, "Signal the Mahouts! Charge!" The necromancers let out cackling, almost unnatural laughs, pointing at the Romans. The trumpets blare, answered by a series of increasingly faint replies from the distance. Pyrrhus mounts and charges to the right wing to take command of the cavalry. It is almost as if the order was never given. The war elephants had been stationed way behind the army, well out of sight of the Romans. Minutes later, the Romans would have noticed a slight tremor under their feet, and perhaps thought nothing of it. Soon, though, the sounds of a strange trumpeting coming from the horizon would have drawn Roman eyes. The Romans had never seen, perhaps never even heard of elephants before. The colossal creatures, 12 to 14 feet high at the shoulder, 20 to 25 feet with the castles on their backs, weighing metric tons upon tons, their long tusks and trunks swinging side to side would have looked like creatures out of myth. This scene always reminds me of the line "Imperial walkers on the North Ridge," just before the Battle of Hoth in Empire Strikes Back, the sense of ominous terror. For good reason, it was Pyrrhus's war elephants that inspired George Lucas to create the Empire's AT-ATs. When the war elephants hit the Roman cavalry with their awesome power, horses were thrown into the air and went flying as if they weighed nothing, crushing the Romans they landed on. The trained and inebriated elephants gored with their tusks, used their trunks to pick up and hurl men, and were constantly moving, trampling anything that got in their way. Their archers shot with deadly accuracy from their vantage point in the castles on their backs, secure in their towers. The Roman horses, unfamiliar with the scent of elephants, became even more terrified than their riders and bolted. The charge of 10 elephants on each flank decimated all the Roman units there. Finally free to do what they excelled at, Pyrrhus's cavalry formed up and charged the now exposed Roman legionaries in their flanks. The elephants were sent in a wide arc to attack the center of the Roman formation from the rear. The legions were decimated and fled. The immovable phalanx, the necromancer's curses, the unmatched skill of the Eagle Epirus, and the awesome presence of the elephants had finally broken them. The legions were routed. They turned and fled for their lives. Pyrrhus ordered his Thessalian cavalry to pursue the fleeing legions. Exhausted, men collapsed to the ground as the adrenaline of battle, which had sustained them for hours, left their bodies. Though this was a victory, it may not have seemed like one because the losses to his irreplaceable Epirot and Macedonian phalangites were very high. His cavalry and vital skirmishers had suffered as well. Pyrrhus's army had suffered 4,000 dead to the Romans' 7,000. And after the rout was complete, his army had also captured 2,000 Roman prisoners. In the following days, things did begin to look up for Pyrrhus as the long-promised forces from Magna Graecia began to arrive. Though not able to fight in the Macedonian phalanx, their numbers at least partially made up for his losses. He decided to send Cinnaeus ahead to Rome to negotiate a peace agreement if possible. To keep pressure on the Romans, he would follow with the entire army. As Cinnaeus traveled north with an honor guard, he stopped at many small towns allied to the Romans, where he offered lavish gifts and huge sums of gold to the leaders to gain their goodwill. All rejected the gifts, telling him that nothing was worth earning the wrath of the Romans. Cinnaeus reached Rome and found it to be a heavily fortified city. Its people, though shocked by the loss, were by no means defeated. Everywhere he went, he saw signs that new legions were being raised, and everyone he talked to spoke only of the next battle with Pyrrhus. The sentiment among the populace was that Pyrrhus had defeated the consul Livianus, not Rome. After a loss like that suffered at Heraclea, any city in the Greek world would be mourning their dead, suing for peace, and begging to ransom back their men taken prisoner. Rome was different. The attitude of Roman virtus, the warrior code of the society, did not allow them to accept defeat. Cinnaeus, ever the skilled diplomat and persuasive orator, addressed the Roman Senate on Pyrrhus's behalf. The richly garbed senators on their raised benches looking down at him must have made it seem like Rome had hundreds of kings. He offered very generous peace terms, along with the friendship and alliance not only of Epirus, but that of the greater Greek world. In addition, Pyrrhus would help Rome conquer the rest of Italy as long as the freedom and independence of Tarentum was guaranteed. This was a tremendous offer and indeed an honor, and as such the Senate was open to discussing it. They adjourned for the day, and senators fought for the honor of hosting Cinnaeus at various dinner parties. The next day it looked like the deal was about to be accepted. However, just as they were about to vote, an old, frail, and blind man was helped into the chamber by servants. His name was Appius Claudius, a former consul and hero of the Samnite Wars. In many ways he was to the Romans what Alexander was to the Greeks. He said that Pyrrhus and the Greeks were not to be trusted, that Cinnaeus should be sent away immediately, and that no peace negotiations could begin until Pyrrhus left Italy entirely. He gave a rousing speech and shamed the Senate, saying that they had forgotten that they were Romans. As he was carried out of the chamber, the Senate unanimously voted to reject the peace terms and eject Cinnaeus from Rome. When Cinnaeus returned to the army, now camped less than 100 miles from Rome, Cinnaeus said to Pyrrhus, "I fear we are fighting a hydra," meaning the mythical creature with many heads. When he cut one off, two more grew in its place. It turned out that Pyrrhus had had little success in convincing many Roman allied or subjugated towns to his side, though with hindsight, the reason for this is plain. For some insane reason, he had allowed his army free rein to pillage and plunder as they moved north, hardly a way to convince the locals you had come as liberators. I'm just gonna say it, our mushroom-chomping friends may have played a huge role in this decision. Pyrrhus's army on the move would have been like a swarm of locusts, ravaging the landscape for miles around their route of march, a foraging, pillaging, plundering, raping, and murdering swarm. The news of the strength of Rome's walls and defenses, the will of its people, coupled with Pyrrhus's failure to draw more support and his lack of a proper siege train, would have made continuing onto and attempting to besiege Rome a horrible mistake. In addition, a Roman envoy had just told Pyrrhus of a plot on his life by a physician who had offered to poison him in exchange for talents of gold and sanctuary in Rome. The envoy slipped the warning to Pyrrhus and said, "Romans know how to achieve their goals thanks to their bravery and do not fight their enemies with trick, deceit, or ambush like you Greeks." When the physician was questioned and the plot was discovered to be true, Pyrrhus released all Roman prisoners in thanks. Not to be outdone, the Romans released citizens from various cities in Magna Graecia and all of Pyrrhus's scouts they had captured. A kind of chivalric respect was developing between the enemies. That didn't mean that either side was letting its guard down for a second. And with the season turning, they were forced to settle in for the winter. In early spring, 279 BCE, Pyrrhus discovered that the two Roman consuls had been busy all winter raising new legions to the southeast of his position, in what's modern Apulia. Sensing that the Romans meant to trap his army on enemy ground, Pyrrhus decided to strike first and made directly for the massive force.
his army again a moving whirlwind of destruction to their surroundings. As they marched, some few contingents of Rome's most implacable and not long subjugated foes did join Pyrrhus, but they were few in number and of questionable loyalty, thus making their utility in battle extremely limited. Though his commanders thought marching directly to face the legions of Rome on what would be ground of their choosing dangerous in the extreme, the Eagle of Epirus didn't care. He wanted this fight with the Romans over once and for all so that he could pursue his goal of raising an even more massive army from the grateful Greeks of Magna Graecia and take on the might of Carthage. Again, Pyrrhus's reliance on the words of the necromancers channeling the voices and personalities of Alexander and Achilles may have had more than a little to do with this. In any event, the hunt for the legions was on. I don't want you to get the impression that the Romans weren't shaken by the loss at Heraclea. They were. The survivors had told tales of the valor and skill of Pyrrhus and his companions, tales of strange spells, prayers, and the powers of the necromancers blown out of all proportion in the retelling, and of course the terrifying elephants, who the Romans called Lucanian oxen in order to normalize them in their minds. In a strange coincidence, the battlefield had the two armies separated by a river, much like that at Heraclea, though this time the terrain was vastly different. It was marshy and uneven ground, parts of it forested with small glades of trees. In other words, horrible ground for a phalanx to fight on, and also pretty bad for cavalry. Both excelled on flat open ground, so it is hard to know why Pyrrhus chose to attack near the town of Asculum. The much more flexible, manipular legions would have the advantage, but much of the marshy ground would simply become a quagmire for both sides. Ancient battles were often lost because of a much less obvious handicap. Perhaps he meant for the legions to get bogged down and lose their maneuverability, but knowing Pyrrhus, it may have been that he was just eager to fight no matter what the terrain. The armies camped not far apart and spent a few days resting and sizing each other up. Word reached Pyrrhus that both Roman consuls were present, and that the consul Publius Decimus Mus had decided to make himself a devotion. This was a human sacrifice. He would be blessed by priest, his body painted and anointed. Then he would ride directly into enemy lines at the beginning of battle, swinging his sword and dying in combat for the glory of Rome. This was supposed to bring the favor of the gods to the Roman side and deny their favor to the enemy for the duration of the battle. This ritual was performed only in an extreme emergency when Rome absolutely had to win. There is another reason that Consul Mus may have been so ready to sacrifice himself. He was the man who had killed Megacles after he switched armor with his friend and king in order to draw the attention of the best Roman warriors. Pyrrhus knew this and had sworn to kill Mus to avenge his dead friend. Mus knew that he was a dead man, so why not inspire the army and gain the favor of the gods in a devotion? At least that way his death would mean something, and his name would forever be honored in Rome. Pyrrhus sent word that if Mus tried it, he would be pulled off his horse and face days of torture. Mus was shocked to silence, but the other consul, a man named Sulpicius Severio, replied, "The Romans need no devotio to defeat you." The Romans and Pyrrhus were evenly matched in number. Both sides had just over 40,000 men each. The sources say that the Romans had prepared a new unit of 300 war wagons with fire and rope weapons as an anti-elephant force. These were more likely 60 or so light chariots, very fast and agile, some equipped with a grapple and rope to tangle the elephant's legs to trip them, others with missile weapons to harass the giant creatures and their drivers, and finally some kind of ranged fire weapon, probably thrown torches or fire arrows. The fact that they put such effort into these unorthodox weapons should tell us how much they feared the charge of the war elephants. We know Pyrrhus somehow got word of them. Or perhaps he predicted that the Romans would have come up with some response to his precious elephants, because he placed most of his skirmishers with them as a screening force. Perhaps in response to the uneven ground, perhaps because he did not trust the quality of his allied troops, or even as an answer to the Roman maniple, he broke his phalanx into blocks, and between them placed his allied units. He put the cavalry on the flanks as before, but kept his companions to the rear. He and they would attack up and down the line wherever they were needed most. This way, if the allies wavered, they would quickly have the Eagle of Epirus and his wind fighting at their side. When the enemy lines came together at the Battle of Asculum, the fighting became incredibly fierce and bloody. The Roman cavalry kept their long spears pointed and fought as a stationary line, which largely negated the lightning-quick hammer blows, the in and out, of Pyrrhus's heavy cavalry. Wherever the fighting was most brutal, Pyrrhus was there leading the counterattack himself. However, not even he could be in all places at once.
The Romans fought with desperate ferocity, for after the loss at Heraclea, the honor of Rome was at stake. Each maniple eager to be the one to break the enemy line. Many did come close a few times, but before long they were pushed back by Pyrrhus. Not wanting the fight to go on as long as it had in the previous battle, Pyrrhus called for the elephants to charge relatively early. Once in sight, the Romans launched their chariots at them. The battle that followed was the final inspiration for George Lucas's Battle of Hoth in Empire Strikes Back, with the chariots hooking elephant legs and then desperately circling, hoping to trip them, like Luke and Rogue Squadron tripping the Imperial walkers. The chariot attack was even less successful than Rebel speeders, though. The boggy ground greatly slowed the chariots, and Pyrrhus's slingers and archers made short work of them. Just as in the last battle, the war elephants scattered the Roman cavalry and crashed into the legions. Within minutes, the legions were in full flight from the battlefield, quickly pursued by his Thessalian cavalry. However, just as he and his cavalry were forming to execute a charge and fully rout the Romans, word of the inconceivable came. Their camp, miles behind the lines, was under attack. You see, a few Roman allied units had been late to the battle, and while marching to meet the legions, had come upon the lightly defended enemy camp. For an ancient army, its camp held everything of value, all their food, spoils, gold, slaves, and supplies. This was an emergency, so instead of charging down and destroying the fleeing legions, Pyrrhus was forced to send his cavalry and elephants in a desperate charge to stop the destruction of their camp. Though in time to stop the pillaging and recover most of what gold was looted, the attackers had succeeded in burning most of his war supplies, massive amounts of food, weapons, replacement armor, and precious maps. A disaster by any metric. After the battle, a tally was made of the casualties. There were 6,000 dead Romans to Pyrrhus's 3,550. Almost all of Pyrrhus's best friends and officers were dead. An allied commander congratulated Pyrrhus, who said, "One more such victory, and we are undone." This phrase became famous and gave birth to our modern saying, a Pyrrhic victory, meaning a victory that cost so much, it may as well have been a defeat. Pyrrhus must have been bitterly lamenting his decision to come to Italy in the days following the battle, when two envoys arrived from very different places, both begging for his help. One from Macedonia, that was being threatened by a horde of barbarian Gauls. The other from the city of Syracuse in Sicily, locked in a life-and-death struggle with Carthage. In addition, the Tarentines who were there to witness these offers protested that Rome was not yet defeated. Telling them that he needed the night to think and consult the gods before he would give them his decision, he retired to his tent. He prayed that night to Zeus, his forefathers, Apollo and Athena, and in the morning went to the envoys to give them his decision. Now we don't know exactly what it was like in Pyrrhus's ruined camp, but it might have gone something like this. It is a cold night on the marshy plain near the village of Asculum. You are looking at the burnt remnants of the once fortified camp of an army that should have been celebrating a glorious victory. It is a somber, even sad scene of thousands of warriors sleeping in the open because their tents had been burned while they were away winning a massive battle. Most of their belongings looted, and though much was recovered, much more is in the possession of other men. In the distance, the elephants can be heard mournfully trumpeting. Though the Roman attempts to bring them down had failed, all of them were wounded with deep cuts that even their thick hides couldn't fully protect them from. One is so badly wounded that it will have to be put down, though as yet the matriarch of the herd will not allow it. The sad calls from the herd to its dying member become a song that sums up the despair of the victorious army. The fact is, every man still alive feels guilty for surviving the battle because they lost dear friends and heroic captains. Perhaps if they had been able to hunt down the routed Roman army and taken their vengeance and the spoils with it, it would have been some consolation. But that didn't happen. At the peak of the bloody contest, after the war elephants had decimated the Roman formations, just when the heavy cavalry was grouping to charge the fleeing army and execute the full rout, ready and eager to repay the Romans tenfold for their losses, a vast plume of smoke was seen rising from miles behind the line. The camp, their home, was burning. Instead of finishing the battle, your king and his cavalry had to rush back to attack the thousands of Italian barbarians who, late to the battle, had taken the lightly defended camp completely by surprise. Though most of the army's treasury was saved, the food, pack animals, tents, clothes, small keepsakes from distant homelands, and campaign supplies were all gone, consumed by the massive inferno caused by the raiders. There is one tent standing in the middle of the camp, a common soldier's tent, though this night it is home to a king. Within, Pyrrhus of Epirus is consulting with the gods, praying for guidance, alone except for the strange priest from the Necromantion of Acheron, who men believed could allow the king to talk directly to his ancestors. Though the morale of the army is low, faith in Pyrrhus has never been higher. Just days before, the king had fought beside them, charging up and down the line, saving many of their lives, and leading them to victory. He personally lost nearly all of his closest advisors, men who had been with him since boyhood, his dearest friends, all dead except Cineas. Amid the feelings of grief, there is also a sense of anticipation in the camp, for all know of the two envoys who came to the king asking for aid after the battle. One from Macedonia, begging for him to lead the army back across the Adriatic, march through and resupply in Epirus, and rush to confront a so far unbeatable horde of barbarian Gauls ravaging the countryside, burning towns, and even now bearing down on the capital city of Pella. The reward for this? The crown and throne of Macedon. Pyrrhus could take his place among the monarchs of the successor realms carved out of Alexander's empire, the downside being a hard campaign against a much more numerous foe, with a very uncertain outcome, and once victorious, ascending to the throne, only having to live in the viper's pit that is politics in the Greek world. The second from the powerful, cultured, and very advanced Greek city of Syracuse in Sicily. The island was filled with the farthest colonies of Magna Graecia. The city was even now besieged by a Carthaginian army. The island is toxically divided between the multifactional Greek cities, the mighty naval empire of Carthage, and a sadistic cult dedicated to the war god. The reward offered is incredible amounts of gold and silver, massive amounts of supplies, a probable crown from the grateful citizens of the city, and a chance to campaign and win control of the very rich island. In truth, there is a third party involved in this. The commanders of the White Shields from Tarentum have also pled their case to Pyrrhus. They insist that Pyrrhus stay and finish the war with the Romans as he had agreed to defend Tarentum. A case could be made that it was the Tarentines who lied about the causes of the war, failed to live up to many promises of troops and support, and that they had been forced to fight alongside Pyrrhus for their own freedom. Any rewards they promised aside, the massive downside would be facing the Roman legions again, a thought no one in the army relished. In the early morning, Pyrrhus exits his tent and is quickly approached by the eager envoys. He points to one of his signalers who blows his trumpet, the familiar sound calling the army to muster. Also in answer, an elephant trumpets and jogs over to Pyrrhus. Though standing 12 feet tall at the shoulder and massive, everyone knows the young bull that Pyrrhus treats like a favored hound and has become something of a mascot for the army. Without prompting, the elephant kneels, offering himself as a mount. Pyrrhus seats himself astride the elephant's neck, his legs dangling behind the animal's huge ears. From the great height on the mighty beast, Pyrrhus addresses not the envoys, but the assembled army. He tells them of his consultations with the gods and his ancestors. With tears flowing, he laments their lost comrades. And finally, as if lit by an inner fire, his eyes fill with resolve. He is the eagle again. He asks the army if they trust his judgment. The men roar in answer. He asks if they want to go home with a taste of bitter victory on their tongues, or if they should honor their fallen by ensuring they did not die in vain. The army roars even louder this time. No longer asking, he tells them that the only way to achieve this is to conquer, so that their names would ring through history and never be forgotten. He tells them it is time for them to take it all. He draws his sword and points to the west. The army roars again. A chant of "Eagle! Eagle! Eagle!" quickly rises. Pyrrhus stands on his mount and yells, "If I am your eagle, know you are the wind that allows me to fly." The roar of the army is deafening and is quickly joined by the trumpeting herd of elephants. At least it might have gone like that. With the decision to aid Syracuse and engage Carthage made, the army made preparations for the long march to the coast. Pyrrhus informed the Tarentines that he would be back if the Romans troubled the city again, and as a symbol of this, he sent 600 men to garrison the city and man its walls in the event the Romans attacked. The disappointed Tarentine contingent of White Shields left the army. After the costly campaign against Rome, Pyrrhus had 11,000 infantry, 1,500 cavalry, 19 war elephants, and perhaps 1,000 mixed skirmishers for his Sicilian campaign, a far cry from his original army. Though it was a battle-hardened and elite force, by this time used to difficult fighting and experts at their craft. A quick word about the geography. Remember, Italy is the boot, and the island of Sicily is the ball it's kicking. To keep things simple, you can picture Pyrrhus's journey across the island as a push east to the far shore, and then a push west back towards Italy. In addition, many of the details of his campaign against Carthage are lost to history, so I've reconstructed the story using the few sources that are left to us. With the siege of Syracuse underway, and upon hearing that Pyrrhus was coming, the Carthaginians made an alliance with Rome. It should give you some insight to just how badly they wished to rid themselves of Pyrrhus, that the never-friendly, future nemesis agreed to this pact. Carthage, being the preeminent naval power, and until its recent defeats, Rome the preeminent land power, agreed to play on each other's strengths. The Carthaginian navy would transport the legions wherever they needed to go around the Italian mainland, as long as their aggression was aimed at Pyrrhus or his allies in Magna Graecia. Beside the Greek city-states and Carthage, there was another power on Sicily, called the Mamertines, in Latin the Sons of Mars, to the Greeks the Cult of Ares. They were a quasi-nation of ex-mercenaries who religiously devoted themselves to the worship of the war god to the exclusion of all others. They controlled many towns in the northeast and many more fortresses in the rocky interior of the island. From these they would tax the Greek cities and even at times the Carthaginians for protection. They were fanatical warriors, and there were tens of thousands of them. So many skilled warriors, in fact, that even powerful cities like Syracuse would at times just pay them off rather than risk battle with them. If you were to describe them as something akin to an ancient Isis, you wouldn't be far off. They were led by their strongest warriors and fought in the way their original mercenary bands did, so it was a strange army with various types of units. At this moment, the cult held Messana, modern Messina, and had just allied themselves with Carthage in a pact against Pyrrhus in an effort to deny him a port on the east coast of the island. With no safe harbor nearby, Pyrrhus found a friendly town between Syracuse and Messana and landed there. Caught between two enemies, Pyrrhus decided to march directly to Syracuse. Instead of facing his army, however, upon hearing of his approach, the Carthaginians lifted their siege and quickly marched away. The city's gates were thrown open, and he was hailed as the savior of Syracuse. Various envoys arrived from many different Greek cities and sent word that they pledged him their support, and he was named High King of Sicily, though it appears if he wanted a capital city, he would have to conquer one for himself. They did send troops, supplies, and pledges of access to their treasuries to pursue the war. With the addition of the Sicilian levies, Pyrrhus once again had 30,000 infantry, though we are not sure of their precise makeup. It's safe to assume that it was a typical mix of units common in Magna Graecia, many thousands of older Greek-style hoplites that fought in compact phalanxes, along with archers, and for the first time Pyrrhus had a dedicated siege train. This meant that he would have the ability to take walled towns and cities by storm using siege ladders, towers, and rams, a crucial element that his army had been lacking in Italy. Pyrrhus wasted no time and set out. On his way across the mountainous center of the island, Pyrrhus caught and executed every Mamertine tax collector he came across and sent the tribute they had collected back to the extorted towns with the message that they no longer needed to fear the cult of Ares. This brought dozens of small towns over to his side. As he approached the west coast, he fought a major battle against a large Carthaginian garrison at a place called Heraclea Minoa. All we know is that he routed that army with ease. This victory caused major cities like Segesta to come over to his side. This was a huge blow to Carthage. Not one to rest on his laurels, Pyrrhus made straight for the largest enemy force left in the island's interior, the mighty fortress of Eryx. It had strong natural defenses and strong fortifications, though these did not daunt Pyrrhus. His mind was set, so his army laid siege to the fortress. The siege lasted months, and the fighting was brutal. Pyrrhus is said to have led many assaults on the walls himself, often being the first man to climb upon the battlements. This is where Plutarch says he slew the mercenaries of Carthage in heaps without ever taking a wound. After a series of all-out assaults on the walls, Eryx was taken by storm. Its fall sent a shockwave around the island and led to every city allied to Carthage to come over to Pyrrhus's side, except one, the mighty port of Lilybaeum on the far western tip of Sicily. As the army advanced to the coast, Carthage sent an embassy to negotiate with Pyrrhus, offering extraordinarily generous peace terms. They would recognize him as High King of Sicily, would give up all claims to any of his lands, and pay a huge annual tribute in gold if they could retain Lilybaeum for the purposes of trade. By any metric, this was an incredible deal. You see, Lilybaeum was no mere town. Its fortifications had three interlinked and supportive walls and were considered second only in strength to the walls of Carthage itself. In addition, the port was also a major base for the Carthaginian navy. It contained thousands of troops and a very loyal population. The consensus in the ancient world was that Lilybaeum was impregnable. Taking it by force would at the very least be difficult in the extreme, time-consuming, and cost thousands of lives. In that context, we can see that the peace offer was generous indeed. At this time, there were a series of assassination attempts on Pyrrhus's life, most likely executed by the Mamertines. The cult had declared a blood feud on him after he killed their tax collectors and marked him for death. Perhaps it was because he blamed these attempts on Carthage, bad advice from his counselors, the mushroom enthusiasts, his sublime ego, or the advice of one of the many factions on the island he now ruled, but Pyrrhus turned down the embassy and laid siege to Lilybaeum. 2 months of brutal fighting ensued. Pyrrhus led many sorties on the city walls and was always repulsed with heavy losses. To make matters worse, the Carthaginian navy was supreme on the seas and quickly dealt with the rather amateur quality of Pyrrhus's navy during an assault he launched on the harbor. As a result of this defeat, the city was able to be constantly resupplied from Carthage in Africa and from Sardinia. They had food, supplies, and a constant stream of fresh troops. With his losses mounting, Pyrrhus was forced to lift the siege. Now think back to the beginning of this episode. If you remember his conversation with Cineas, Pyrrhus's plan all along was to conquer Carthage and take over its empire. To this end, after the bloody siege had ended in a very public loss, he ordered the construction of a fleet of 200 ships. This was an extremely expensive endeavor, and nearly all of the cities he ruled hated the expense. In addition, he couldn't get enough men to crew the ships as they were completed, so he began to conscript rowers and crewmen. Again, extremely unpopular. And even with this extreme measure, it was proving impossible to man the only partially completed fleet. During this time, he was not idle. Not forgetting the cult of Ares, the Mamertines, Pyrrhus took his army east and defeated them in a few minor battles, taking their coastal holdings, including their capital at Messana. The cultists were forced into the rocky interior of the island. Ridding the Greeks of such a major nuisance like the Mamertines should have rekindled support. However, due to the heavy taxes for the fleet, and the very unpopular policy of conscription, many cities named him a tyrant and went over to Carthage. Some even welcomed the Mamertines into their towns. One after another, the cities of Sicily revolted. So after 3 years of war, Pyrrhus had achieved nothing except earning the eternal hatred of the cult of the war god, a damaged reputation, and had become the eternal enemy of Rome. Again, seemingly out of nowhere, at just the right time, an envoy arrived from Tarentum, telling him that the Romans had more than recovered their losses and now were punishing every town that had aided Pyrrhus. He agreed to return to the mainland and fight their war. During the crossing, his fleet was attacked by the Carthaginian navy. It was a rout. Out of his 110 warships, 98 were sunk. In addition, the ships carrying most of his gold were sunk, though it seems most of the transports carrying his army made it to shore safely. You can picture where he landed as the toe of the boot that is southern Italy. After they assembled and began their march inland, they were ambushed by a strike force of 10,000 Mamertines. The fanatics had gathered their best warriors and followed Pyrrhus across the strait to get revenge and carry out their blood feud. The ambush was conducted while Pyrrhus's army was on the march. A violent and bloody battle ensued, with the rear of the long line of march suffering huge casualties, including two elephants. The fighting was very intense. Pyrrhus took a vicious sword wound to the head, and bleeding profusely, was being pulled from the fighting in the rear to the relative safety of the middle of the line of march. It was then that the leader of the Mamertines called out, mocking Pyrrhus as a coward and daring him to face him. Pyrrhus shrugged off his men, who were begging him to ignore the huge warrior. He drew his sword, and in a scene out of a movie, began to jog towards the man. The cult leader roared his battle cry and his men cheered. He struck first with a huge arcing swing at Pyrrhus, but missed and left himself open to a counterattack. According to the sources, the blow that Pyrrhus dealt cut the man from shoulder to groin. Pyrrhus sheathed his sword, and as he turned and began to walk back to his men, the leader of the Mamertines fell in two pieces. At the sight of this, the cult of Ares lost all heart, apparently collectively deciding that they wanted nothing more to do with this warrior king. As the army made its way to Tarentum, Pyrrhus got the lay of the land and a better picture of what had transpired in his absence. The legions, under the command of a consul, were campaigning hard in Samnium, where all the cities that had supported him in any way were being destroyed. Another consul was leading another punitive conquest of the cities of Lucania. Rome was at full strength and stronger than ever.
He found no support forthcoming from any of his old allies, as they were justifiably angry and felt that he had abandoned them to the mercy of the Romans. Only Tarentum supplied him with any sizable number of troops, most likely an expanded corps of the White Shields who he had drilled into existence himself and fought with distinction at Heraclea, as well as a large force of excellent cavalry scouts. The bulk of the reinforcements, however, were conscripted militia of very poor quality. The truth is, we don't know the exact numbers or makeup of the army that marched to meet the Romans. They had suffered losses during the long campaign in Sicily and many more in the Mamertine ambush. We know that he faced the prospect of fighting two consular armies and was desperate to prevent them from uniting. A standard consular army consisted of two legions with their accompanying ala, which would mean approximately 17,000 men per Roman army. Therefore, it's safe to assume that Pyrrhus had around 20,000 men with him as he advanced on the town of Maleventum. The Roman consul, Dentatus, had secured a very strong position, halfway up a tall hill. The legions had built a strong camp there and fortified the position with trenches and towers. They were very well dug in and secure as Pyrrhus made camp at the bottom of the incline. Pyrrhus had some local Samnite scouts who warned him of the approach of the second Roman army, so he detached a small holding force to secure a pass that led to the area so he could deal with Dentatus' legions first. To accomplish his plan, he divided his army. He took his best troops, the surviving Epirot and Macedonian phalanx, along with his elephants in a long and treacherous night march guarded by local and possibly spiteful Samnites on a path that was supposed to lead them behind and above the Roman camp, with the rest of his army securing the base of the hill. This pincer movement was supposed to take the Romans completely by surprise so that they would wake to find an army in their lightly fortified rear while still facing a very significant force in front. Night marches in the ancient world were notoriously treacherous. Moving through the woods at night, even with modern equipment, is difficult, let alone thousands of armored men, horses, and elephants led by torchlight, desperately trying to move silently. It turned out to be a disaster. Instead of the relatively short march he had been promised, the army got lost several times, perhaps misled by the Samnites intentionally as revenge for Pyrrhus leaving them to face the Romans alone after Asculum. The march took many hours and led the army across an open ridge so that they were easily spotted in the early morning by the Romans. When they emerged from the woods, all surprise had been lost and the enemy was ready for them. The Romans were fed and rested, while Pyrrhus' men were exhausted, cold, and hungry. I'm not sure why he decided to press the attack under the circumstances. It may have been that the other half of the army was going to or was already attacking. Perhaps he was worried about the other Roman army closing in on the region. All we know is that he ordered his men to form the phalanx. When the armies engaged, Pyrrhus and his men discovered that they were fighting a vastly improved enemy. As always, the Romans had learned from their mistakes. The legions were now used to fighting the Macedonian phalanx and were familiar with Pyrrhus' tactics. In fact, these legions had been specifically trained to fight against him. They fought hard, desperately trying to break the phalanx, knowing that if enough of them could get past the first five spears, they could begin to open a hole in the line. Still, Pyrrhus and his veterans held and even pushed the Romans back in places. The fighting was fierce, so Pyrrhus sent in his elephants to break the legions as they had in previous battles. This time, however, the Romans were ready. They had equipped each legionary with extra javelins and kept units of skirmishers in reserve just for this eventuality. They peppered the elephants with light spears, which did little against the adults with their thick hides. There was, however, a juvenile among the herd, and its thin hide did much less to protect it against the razor-sharp spears. It was wounded and called out an alarm for its mother. The herd, alarmed by this, charged back to aid the fleeing elephant. The result was that they charged straight through Pyrrhus's lines and trampled all in their path, destroying the cohesion of the phalanx. Seeing the massive holes in the enemy lines, the Romans charged and routed all but the most experienced troops, who Pyrrhus led in a measured tactical withdrawal. The Romans herded the elephants into a secluded grove and forced their mahouts to surrender. They captured 8, the rest having fallen in battle. They kept them, and the herd became a wonder to all the people of Rome. The Romans then turned and marched to confront the other half of Pyrrhus's army making its way up the hill. These were troops of much lower quality and led by less inspired commanders. They were quickly routed by the professional legionaries. Upon emerging from the forest, Pyrrhus led a perilous retreat all the way to Tarentum. We don't know the casualty numbers for either side, but they must have been very high for Pyrrhus. We do know that Pyrrhus didn't linger long in the city. he gathered all the men left to him and took ship for Epirus, having spent 5 years in a war whose only result was an infinitely more powerful Roman army, an emboldened Carthaginian navy, and the Mamertines desperate to make up their losses at all cost. It is said that as his ship put out to sea, Pyrrhus glanced back at Italy and said, "What a wrestling ground we have left for Rome and Carthage." Prophetic words, because it was his war that quite literally set the stage for the First Punic War. That is the story of the Pyrrhic War in Magna Graecia. However, Pyrrhus of Epirus, being Pyrrhus of Epirus, wouldn't go home and enjoy his kingdom. Upon reaching Epirus, he assembled another, though much smaller, army and rode for Macedon, where the barbarian Gallic horde was now in control of much of the countryside. At this time, there was another Antigonid king, a son of Alexander's powerful general Antigonus One-Eye on the Macedonian throne, who controlled most of the towns and cities. But remember, this is the Greek world. A king who wasn't in absolute control of all of his lands was seen as weak, and weakness brought challenges to your power in the way honey brings flies. Though his wars against Roman Carthage had not gained him anything tangible, his exploits had won him immense fame. Mercenaries flocked to him, eager to fight with the Eagle of Epirus. In addition, Pyrrhus made a pact with the barbarian Gauls and won them over to his side with promises of gold. Not much is known about the battle that ensued, but we do know that Pyrrhus won decisively. He gained the crown and was king of Macedonia. But you may have guessed it already, this was not enough for Pyrrhus. He marched south to Greece and into the Peloponnese to fight Sparta. This resulted in the siege of Sparta, where Spartan women helped dig ditches and themselves fought Pyrrhus's army. In what could be considered Sparta's last glorious historical moment, it defeated Pyrrhus's army and lifted the siege. I am going to thoroughly research this and cover it for you in a future episode. Though defeated at Sparta, most of his army was intact, and always eager to intervene in a fight, he was drawn into an ongoing war on his march back to Macedonia. This resulted in him fighting in the streets of the city of Argos. Always a figure out of the Iliad, Pyrrhus was fighting in the front lines. As he steadily advanced through the streets of the town, he defeated an Argive soldier and had him on his knees before him, about to deliver the death blow. At that very moment, he was struck in the back of the head with a roof tile from above. You see, the Argive soldier's mother was standing on that roof, and desperate to save her son, she threw the tile down at Pyrrhus. The mother's throw succeeded, and her son lived. Well, at least he didn't die at Pyrrhus's hand. The tile crushed Pyrrhus's spine and neck. He fell dead, his sword arm still raised to strike. I think it's almost poetic that a mother's love, expressed in a desperate rage, was what killed Pyrrhus of Epirus, who left the world, the last hero, whose entire life seems like one long Pyrrhic victory, or perhaps a uniquely Pyrrhic defeat. Thank you for listening to Deep into History. I truly hope you enjoyed this episode. If you have a moment, please leave a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. It really helps other people find the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Deep into History and get your daily blast from the past, ask me questions, or just chat. And as always, my friends, nothing but the best to you and yours. I truly look forward to the next time we go deep.